This is Clay from Skilled Gentleman Podcast. You're listening to Handgun World Podcast with Bob Main.
I'm Bob Main. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Welcome to another episode of the Handgun World Podcast. Welcome to episode 449, episode 450 in 2 weeks. Wow, I can't believe that, and I really am looking forward to getting to my 5 millionth download as well. Thank you for listening to me all these years. This week, Tim from Gray Man Strategies has some more information to share with us, this time about the resurgence of double action pistols, traditional double action pistols. Not really my cup of tea. The SIG P229 Legion is fantastic, but I'm not big into them, but a lot of people are. There have been world championships that have been won by people with double action, single action guns. And some people can use them and some people swear by them. So I certainly don't want to neglect them when I'm talking about firearms up there, out there. So Tim is going to do that and bring that to us coming up in just a few minutes. I'd like to remind you that as of now, this podcast is a twice a month show on the 1st and the 15th of every month. So recently, I want to talk about what I did when I was out on podcast vacation. I took the month of December in 2017 to really just do some thinking about this show and where I wanted to take it and what I wanted to do and what I want to be when I grow up. I came to some, you know, what I think are some pretty good decisions and decisions that I'm excited about and I think that you're going to benefit from. And as you know, one of the decisions I made is to have more listener participation in the Handgun World Podcast. People like Tim on this episode and last week, and like Carl Wren, and like Officer Greg from California, and like Dr. Bill from the Firearms Chat Podcast, and people that have sent me audio submissions. I'm putting out the invitation if you would like to do that. I'm really trying to keep them down to about 15 to 20 minutes, but if you got a subject or an area of expertise that you would like to talk about, just record it. Send me some ideas first. Tell me what you want to do. Give me a general idea of what it is that you want to say and what your subject matter is. Record it and send it to me. I'll listen to it, and there's a pretty good chance that you will be part of the Handgun World Podcast. We have a lot to learn from each other, and I don't want you to just listen to me. Boy, I don't know everything, that's for sure. I am always learning, so I am definitely not going to be one of these podcast or radio hosts that come across as a know-it-all, because I know I have just as much to learn as anyone else. So while I was out on podcast vacation, my son and I spent a couple of weeks in the Philippines. Why did we go there? Well, I have met a special lady in the Philippines, and there is a very good chance that I'll be getting married again sometime soon. And that's just kind of, that's the way God works in our lives, and we all operate on His timing. So more on that a little bit later, but while we were out there, we also had a good time, and we also had a pretty good experience. And one of the things I want to talk about when it comes to the Philippines, I felt a little bit, as I say, something was missing. I felt a little bit naked because I could not carry my gun, because I didn't have the same rights in the Philippines that I have here in the United States of America, the great USA. We take it for granted. Even those of you who live in America, even in friendly or gun unfriendly states that aren't quite so friendly to guns, you have it better than a lot of people in some foreign countries. But here's what I'll say. Here's something that impressed me about the Philippines. Even though I was denied my right, well, I don't have a right as far as the Philippine government's concerned, but even though I was denied my human right of carrying a gun for self-defense, nearly every public place that I went to in the Philippines had armed security. And I mean armed security. Usually with AR-15s, a short-barreled shotgun, or an AK. I mean, I went to the mall, armed security and metal detectors. Any kind of a bank or financial institution, armed security, metal detectors. Major grocery stores and supermarkets, armed security. Even some of the smaller businesses and some of the smaller restaurants, armed security. So at least I'm going to have to compliment the government in the Philippines, even though I couldn't carry, they were making some attempt to provide me some security while I was in their country spending money. There are states in America that don't do that. There are states here in the United States that generally, and quite frankly, they mostly take away citizens' right to carry and don't provide any kind of security at all. So my hat's off to the Philippines for at least making an attempt. So we had a good time out there. I'll be giving you more details on my personal life as it develops and things like that, but I wanted you to know that. So next, I want to remind you that this show is sponsored by Concealment Solutions, makers of awesome holsters for concealed carry. All Kydex outside the waistband, excellent inside the waistband, hybrid holsters if you like those, pocket holsters if you like those. Check them out at concealmentsolutions.com. Don't forget that the coupon code HANDGUNWORLD gets you 10% off at checkout. That's all one word, by the way, HANDGUNWORLD, for a 10% discount at Concealment Solutions. And again, their website is www.concealmentsolutions.com. One more time, I want to extend a big thank you to Bill Frady at Lock and Load Radio and, of course, Rob Morse at Self Defense Gun Stories. You know, Bill went out to SHOT Show and he asked Rob to host his show for a week, and Rob invited me and Ben Branham and John Adine. So we spent a lot of time hosting that show. That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. And we had terrific guests. So listen to Lock and Load Radio, and I think you're going to get some real good information from that, as always, from Bill Frady's show. And let me also mention that I put a new YouTube video on my YouTube channel. Of course, you can find my YouTube channel. Just search Handgun World. It might be under the old name of my show, Handgun World Show or Handgun World Podcast. I just put up one up there about, are you carrying your gun? I also have a video up there, a shooting review of both of my new M&Ps, my 2.0 compact 9mm and my version 2.0 shield. Both good shooting reviews up there on my YouTube channel. I've answered the call. I've heard people put out the call that they want me to do more videos. And so there you go. I'm doing more videos and they're on YouTube. Please check out my channel. So as I mentioned earlier in this episode, Tim from Gray Man Strategies, who sent in a real good piece of material last week, has more. I got the first half of it that you're going to hear on double action, single action pistols, why he likes the traditional double action, single action pistols. He starts off with some history in the evolution of guns and things like that, which I found quite interesting. And I think you're going to like that. So here we go. Tim from Gray Man Strategies.
Hey there. My name's Tim, and I'm a firearms instructor in the Charlotte, North Carolina area. I specialize primarily in private instruction revolving around self-defense with a handgun. And I also teach concealed carry classes for those wishing to get their North Carolina permit. I encourage you to check out graymanstrategies.com on the web, where you can learn more about me and the training that I offer. I want to start off again by thanking Bob for being gracious enough to allow me to share some ideas with you on his podcast. I wish him the best on his break, and I look forward to his return and more of those practical podcasts from a practical guy. I also apologize in advance if I happen to come across as a little froggy this time around. I've got a bit of a cold, and I'll make an effort to edit out any sneezing and wheezing, but it may slip through anyway. I don't think you have to worry about catching anything over a podcast, though. On the last segment, we talked about standards, their importance in our practice routines, and how we can use them to set goals, to progress, you know, to get where we want to be as shooters. This time around, we're going to talk about gear. More specifically, carry guns. Even more specifically, my carry gun and why I chose what I chose. Now, you may be saying, whoop-de-doo, who cares what you carry? And yeah, fair enough, I understand. Choice of carry gear usually comes down to a bunch of very personal decisions based on a wide variety of factors. There simply is no one-size-fits-all with this, and I'm not suggesting anything otherwise. I do feel like there's benefit in discussing this kind of thing on occasion, though, because it gives us insight into someone else's decision-making process and the criteria that they judge by, which can highlight things that we had not considered and challenge our assumptions. But I want to start off making one thing very clear. Now, I'm an opinionated guy, and I feel strongly about the conclusions that I've come to for me. But I don't want you to take anything that I say as me saying that this is the right choice and the right way for everyone, because I don't believe that. Choices come down to giving up something to get something we want more. And this discussion will just show you the things that I wanted more, and maybe the things I didn't care so much about. Your list may be entirely different, and I respect that. Now, just because we're going to talk about gear, let's not forget the simple fact that it's the Indian and not the arrow. There's a temptation to think that we can rush out and buy some new piece of gear and it's going to instantly elevate our performances. Gear can help you get there. It can refine your performance, but it doesn't make your performance. The road to greatness is paved with putting in the time and doing the hard work, not making a bunch of purchases. So just keep that in mind. Okay, I think that's enough for the disclaimers. Let's get down to it. The topic this time is the resurgence of traditional double action pistols, or why you might want to consider a TDA gun as your next carry gun. Now, we're going to come at this topic from a few different perspectives here, okay? We're going to talk about the origin of the traditional double-action design. We're also going to discuss its rise in popularity and also why it's not as much in vogue these days. We're going to touch on some common misconceptions about the design and about its use. And then we're going to bring it on home with why I chose a traditional double-action gun as my carry gun and why I believe others are doing the same. So let's get started with a little bit of history. And in order to understand the history, we have to define a few terms here. Let's start off with talking about single action, or SA, guns. Single action guns are those that have a trigger that does one job and one job only. It performs a single action. And that action is to release the hammer to fire the gun. Some of the most iconic guns known today are single-action firearms. With revolvers, you have the Colt single-action Army, the prototypical cowboy gun. And then with semi-autos, you have the venerable 1911. 100 years plus and still going strong. The important thing to keep in mind with a single-action pistol is that, assuming you have a round chambered, if the hammer's not back, pulling the trigger will not fire the gun. That hammer has to either be thumb-cocked or cocked when you rack the slide in order for the gun to be in a condition where it can fire. Next up is double action, or DA. Now with a double action gun, yes, I'm sure you've guessed it, the trigger can do two things. It can both cock the hammer and release it in a single press of the trigger. The first double action guns were revolvers, and this was a huge advancement because, as you recall, with a single action revolver, there's no transition from shot to shot. You had to thumb cock that hammer manually each time. And with a double action pistol, you could just keep pulling the trigger and it would keep firing. So it allowed for a higher rate of fire, or let's say a higher rate of fire with accuracy, because with a single action revolver, you could fan the hammer. That was not necessarily a recipe for accurate shots on target. Now, you did eventually see double-action semi-auto guns as well, the first of which was a fascinating little pocket pistol. It was called the Little Tom, and if you have an interest in firearm history or kooky designs or whatever, I encourage you to Google it and read up on it a little bit. It's a fascinating little gun. It was not particularly popular, but it was a precursor to bigger and better guns. Now, with a double-action semi-auto, you had the advantage of being able to carry the gun without a thumb safety because the double-action trigger press was a longer, heavier trigger press, in part because of the force necessary to move the hammer. But that longer, heavier trigger press was considered the safety. That's why you didn't see external safeties on revolvers. They don't need them. Now, this basically meant that the double-action pistol could be pulled straight from the holster with the hammer down, and the gun was ready to fire. You didn't have to do anything extra to be ready to use it. So it was a faster gun to employ. Now, you do see safeties on modern double-action pistols, and even double-action, single-action pistols. But I think that is more a matter of user preference than necessity. There are some people who just prefer having a manual safety on their gun. But it's not necessary with a double-action pistol. Now, as you might imagine, somebody got to thinking and got clever and said, wouldn't it be great if we had both of these wonderful triggers together in the same gun? With a revolver, you'd have the double action trigger that would let you fire the gun continuously without having to thumb cock the hammer. But if you wanted to, you could thumb cock the hammer and put the gun in single action mode for more precise shots or shots at distance. Now, with a double action, single action, or traditional double action semi-auto, things get even more exciting. That's because with a semi-auto, you have an automatic transition between that safer first long and heavy trigger pull to the really short, light, crisp single action pulls that follow. So you really do have the best of both worlds in a TDA semi-auto. The first DASA semi-auto to come to market was introduced by Walther with their PP series in the mid-1920s. The most notable gun of that series was the Walther PPK. You may know that gun better as the James Bond pistol. Yes, that's right. The James Bond pistol was the first TDA semi-automatic. Pretty cool, huh? Now, it's important to note that the PPK was chambered in what we would consider a pocket pistol caliber, either .32 caliber or .380. And hey, that's kind of fitting because it was pretty much a pocket pistol. you didn't see a traditional double action pistol chambered in what we would consider a modern self-defense caliber until a little bit later. And it was actually Walther, again, responsible for that pistol. And that pistol was the P-38, which they developed at the beginning of World War II for the German military. The P-38 was designed to replace the Luger, which was a much more expensive pistol to manufacture. Now, the design of the Luger is fascinating in its own right, but the P-38 really caught the attention of the U.S. military and other countries as well, because what they saw in it was the ability to have a pistol that could be pulled straight from the holster and employed without the user having to perform any kind of secondary action to make the pistol ready. And if you look at military use of pistols anyway, they're considered secondary weapons. And, you know, you only go to your pistol, in most cases, as a last resort. So you really don't want any kind of extra barrier there to being able to pull the pistol and perform with it. So the popularity of the P-38 led to other companies post-war developing their own versions of the design. And, you know, that's where you see offerings from Beretta with the 92FS, and you see Sig Sauer, you see Smith & Wesson, you see Heckler & Koch. Basically, all of these pistol manufacturers came out with traditional double-action pistols in some form or fashion. And they were widely adopted by militaries and law enforcement agencies worldwide. So, what happened? I mean, you know, here you have a design that really had a lot going for it. It was proven, and it performed well. What changed? Why don't we still see traditional double-action pistols everywhere? Well, that's simple enough to answer, actually. What happened was Glock. Glock brought out the Glock 17, and if you look at the market at the time, the Glock had a lot going for it. It was a high-capacity pistol, 17 plus 1. That pretty much trumped all of the major manufacturers by at least a few rounds, if not more. They also had a higher capacity in a lighter package because of the polymer frame. And with the striker-fired design, there was a single trigger press to learn. And as you can imagine, a single trigger press to learn is a simpler thing to teach, and that had the potential to save agencies and militaries training time, especially with shooters that didn't come to the table with a background in shooting. So, you know, of course, none of that means much if the pistols weren't reliable, but the Glocks, the early Glocks, proved to be extremely reliable. And so you saw more and more agencies transition away from the traditional double-action pistols to striker-fired Glocks. And Glock really did a smart job from a business standpoint of facilitating that change by practically giving away the guns and supporting equipment to establish a foothold in the marketplace. It was also a plus that these polymer pistols were cheaper to manufacture, which led to cheaper to sell, and that was a big deal because the comparable pistols of the time were hammer-fired, steel-framed guns, and they were just a lot more expensive to manufacture. Well, this, of course, led to other manufacturers jumping on the bandwagon and producing their own versions of these polymer striker-fired guns. Now, I think it also speaks volumes to Glock's popularity and success in marketing when you consider that in popular culture, pistol and Glock are pretty much synonymous. If you say Glock, people know you're talking about a pistol. And if you say pistol, oftentimes the assumption is that it's a Glock. Now, I know rap lyrics probably played a role in that, and hey, that's totally cool. But, I mean, that really is a testament to how much they have taken over the market. So where did this put us? Well, what you have is a generation or two of shooters who have grown up shooting nothing but striker-fired guns. And they don't really know anything else. You couple that with the idea that newer is better and simpler is better, and you end up with shooters that have, at best, no knowledge of the older designs, and worst case, have a bunch of misunderstandings about why the designs are what they are and what the actual benefits of the designs are. And that is where this podcast is truly coming from. Because I was one of those shooters. My first exposure to pistol shooting was on my grandfather's 38 caliber Smith & Wesson Model 10 service pistol. But I saw that as more of an antique. You know, it was a relic. Now, not really, of course, but that's how I saw it. And when it came time for me to buy my first pistol, I wanted the best that modern manufacturing had to offer. I wanted every buzzword feature you could possibly cram into that little pistol. So that meant I gravitated towards striker-fired pistols. And that was the first of many. I mean, as you know, one gun is rarely enough. I mean, if the gun bug bites, then, you know, it keeps on biting. And as I picked up other pistols, as I decided to go with different brands or different sized guns, it was always one striker-fired gun to another. I looked at the hammer-fired guns. I mean, you know, there was some curiosity there, but I just didn't see them as being as efficient and easy to use as a striker-fired gun. I mean, in short, I didn't understand why they were the way they were. So how did I go from being pretty much a striker-fired only kind of guy to being the dyed-in-the-wool, traditional double-action guy that I am today? Well, we'll talk about that. But before we do, let's talk about some of the common misconceptions about the double-action, single-action design. The first thing people usually talk about when you bring up a double-action, single-action gun is, oh my gosh, you've got to learn two trigger presses. And that first trigger press is hard. It's hard to be accurate with that double action trigger press. To that I would say, sure, yeah, you do have two trigger presses to learn. However, from a technique standpoint, it's not really two trigger presses. You should be pressing the trigger pretty much the same way, whether you have a long, heavy trigger or a short, light trigger. And that's smooth and consistent. I mean, we're not talking about some insurmountable obstacle here. We're talking about something that simply requires some training. You probably need to get some training. I mean, let's be realistic about what we're talking about here, okay? It's a fine objective to want a gun that is simple to operate. And ideally, you want a gun for defense that is pretty much a point-and-shoot kind of thing. However, don't think that just because a gun is simple to operate, that means an untrained person is going to be able to pick it up and perform with proper technique to a high level of skill. It's just not going to happen. That's not how things work. I mean, hammers are pretty simple tools to operate, but that doesn't mean you can pick up a hammer and be a master craftsman. It just does not work like that. Consistently skillful performances require consistent skill. It really is that simple. Now, when people talk about the double action trigger pull being too hard to learn, it's too long, it's too heavy, you know, all the other stuff, what they're missing is that there really is benefit in putting in the time and mastering it. For one thing, it's been said for many, many years that if you can shoot a double action pistol well, you can shoot anything. And there's a lot of truth to that. If you develop the trigger control to master a longer, heavier trigger pull, it's much easier to adapt that to anything all the way down to a light single action trigger pull. But also, what they're missing is that that longer trigger pull is really where the safety comes from. It's not so much the trigger weight, because honestly, under stress, you can pull through a 15 or 20 pound trigger and not really feel it. If you're really amped up, that's not really going to feel like much of a trigger pull. It's really the length of travel that gives you the extra layer of safety with the trigger. And that's important, because I've seen people of all skill levels under stress, even just the stress of performing against a timer or in a match or doing a drill, whatever. I mean, just we're talking like very light stress, okay? But even under that little bit of stress, they get ahead of themselves and they get their finger on the trigger early and they don't even realize it. With a double action trigger pull, you have a little bit more forgiving trigger there. It's not going to be as potentially disastrous if you're on the trigger early. In fact, proper double action trigger technique will have you on the trigger a little bit early, because you'll still pull through that trigger press in such a way to where, as you are presenting, the gun fires when you reach full extension. I think that's a good feature, honestly. I think it takes advantage of human nature under stress. Now, that brings up another point. With the double action trigger pull, what I have seen is that there are a lot of people who are just doing it wrong. I have seen people trying to snatch that double action trigger press at the very last moment as if it was a single action trigger. Well, that's not going to work. So then what you see is they rethink it a little bit, and then they start trying to stage the trigger. You know, they'll pull through a good bit of that trigger pull and hold it and wait to make the shot and then snatch the last little bit. Well, no. That's not how you're supposed to be pulling the trigger, now is it? It's always supposed to be a smooth, consistent pull from start to finish. And just because you're talking about a longer, heavier trigger pull doesn't change that. And then you have the people who say that it's unrealistic to expect to be able to train people to decock the gun when they're done firing. Because after all, you've taken a double action pistol and in the course of firing, you have put it into single action mode, which is not the mode that you want to be in when you come off of target or going back into the holster. And, you know, I don't buy that. I mean, we're not talking about rocket science here. We're talking about skills that just need to be ingrained. It's no different than the people who talk about, you know, having a thumb safety on the pistol is a recipe for disaster. Well, yeah, sure it is. If you're talking about an untrained user carrying the gun like that, sure. Because they haven't put in the time, they haven't built up the skills that they need to operate the gun without having to think about it. And when you're in a life and death situation, the thing you want your processing power to go to, you know, your thought process, you want it to be focused on solving the problem, not how do I use this tool again? No, that's not the kind of thing you want to be wrapped up in.
Well, thank you, Tim. That's good information. You're going to hear the rest of his story in the next episode. Notice he's going to talk about how he made the transition from striker-fired guns over to traditional double-action, single-action. But I really like how he just went through some brief history and the progression of service pistols mainly. I learned a couple things from that. Tim, thanks again. When I put out the next episode, everyone's going to get a chance to hear the rest of your story. If you want to send in a submission to this podcast, if you want to record some audio, send it on in. Email me at bob@handgunworld.com. Give me a little bit of an idea as to what it is that you want to talk about, what you want to say, maybe some bullet points or a little outline, then record it and email it to me at bob@handgunworld.com, or you can just put in handgunworld@gmail.com if you typically use Gmail. And you know, I want this to be a listener participated podcast. That's the only way I can think of to put it right now. The show is about you. It's about listeners. And you folks out there that listen to this, a lot of you have some very good knowledge, very good talent, and I want my listeners to hear from you. Also, remember, my voicemail number is 210-646-1727. I have a voicemail that came in recently. Dave, I'm going to get to that. It'll be in the next episode. Again, 210-646-1727. If you have a question or comment and you'd like to be on the podcast, I'd like to hear from you about that. Coming up next, there might be Andrew Branca's Case of the Week. If you don't hear Andrew Branca's Case of the Week, that's because I had to post this on February 1st before Andrew sent me his Case of the Week. So if he doesn't send it to me, I'll record something else after this brief break.
Well, yeah, it's getting tough out there. Yeah, no doubt. I work in home invasions mostly. Some murder, occasional rape. And I'm a huge advocate of gun control. Absolutely. Competition is stiff, and it doesn't help that every time I kick in a door or smash a window, that I face the possibility of being shot and killed. Listen, the fact is, allowing citizens to own guns creates a hostile work environment for me and my associates. No one should have to work under those conditions. I say make them all illegal, absolutely. Make all gun ownership illegal. I mean, I break the law for a living. I'm a professional, so it doesn't really bother me. I mean, but personally, knowing that most homeowners don't have guns, that would make me a lot more comfortable, more confident, and it would surely increase productivity. No doubt. No doubt.
Your local violent criminals work hard and put their lives on the line every time they attempt to murder, rape, abduct, or assault a member of the citizenry. They desperately need your help. With your support, there may finally come a day when a violent criminal can have his way with you or someone you love without the fear, anxiety, and stress caused by knowing there's a possibility his victim might be armed. Please show your support by voting for stronger anti-gun legislation, because criminals prefer unarmed citizens.
Greetings, Handgun World Podcast, and thanks for having me on to share the Law of Self-Defense Case of the Week. I'm attorney Andrew Branca. This content is provided for general educational purposes only. It does not constitute legal advice. If you are in need of legal advice, you must consult with competent legal counsel licensed to practice in the relevant jurisdiction. Today's case of the week is Green v. State out of the Georgia Supreme Court 2 days ago, January 29th, 2018. And in this case, the appellant, the person bringing the appeal, he's Green, along with two of his friends, had gotten himself involved in an ongoing dispute, a beef with the victim of the use of force over allegations of a stolen firearm. The victim had been informed that the appellant and his friends were repeatedly driving past the victim's house and, quote-unquote, mean mugging, I guess making mean faces. And the victim apparently believed that there was a danger that the appellant and his friends would attempt to attack him. So the victim positioned himself immediately outside his home where he could see the street where they were driving by all the time and armed himself with a gun. Now, at some point, the appellant and his friends, in fact, stopped their car, pulled up in front of the victim's home, and got out of their car themselves holding guns. The appellant and one friend started yelling at the victim and then started punching the victim while attempting to take the victim's gun away from him. They were unsuccessful. The two attackers backed off, and at that point, the second friend stepped up to the victim and shot the victim in the face. Now, not a legal issue, but interesting from a tactical perspective, the victim got shot in the face, fell down, and then got back up and exchanged gunfire with his three attackers. So shot in the face, but not out of the fight. Something for us to keep in mind. Unfortunately for the victim, he would ultimately succumb to his injuries and he would die a short time later. The appellant and his two friends were charged with malice murder, and they were tried together in a single trial. And during that trial, the appellant's legal defense was essentially an alibi defense, that it wasn't him. He wasn't there. He didn't have anything to do with the shooting. He was somewhere else. Ultimately, the jury found all three men guilty as charged of malice murder. The appellant then appealed his conviction on several grounds, the ones of interest to us being that he claimed he had ineffective assistance of counsel at trial because his trial lawyer failed to request a jury instruction on either self-defense or mutual combat. The fact that mutual combat came up as an issue opens the door for us to discuss this very interesting legal doctrine within use of force law. And the interesting thing about mutual combat is that it does two seemingly contradictory things at the same time. First, mutual combat, if it was found, your use of force was found to be mutual combat, strips you of self-defense. You lose self-defense. That's bad. On the other hand, what it also does is it can mitigate what would have been a murder conviction down to a manslaughter conviction. Now, for law-abiding people like us, a manslaughter conviction doesn't feel like a win. You're still looking at a sentence of 15, 20 years, sometimes more than that. But it is way better than a murder conviction. Typically, a murder conviction may be life in prison without possibility of parole. That's it. Curtain's closed. With a manslaughter conviction, you might get sentenced to 10 or 15 or 20 years. But under many state systems, you could potentially be eligible for parole in a third of that time. So you might just end up serving a few years, get out, still have some kind of life available to you. So if you're staring a murder conviction in the face, the mitigating that to manslaughter is a win. So let's talk a little bit about what mutual combat is and the consequences for use of force law and how it's treated in terms of use of force law. So mutual combat is essentially when two people or more, agree to a physical combat to settle their differences. Let's go outside and settle this like men. like idiots, of course. Only idiots would do such a thing, but people, a lot of idiots out there. Thankfully, I guess they pay for my costly German motorcycles. So two people or more agree to go out, settle their differences. Now, how is this treated under the law? Well, as a first step, if you're a mutual aggressor, your use of force can't have been self-defense because you're both deemed to be mutual aggressors in that fight. And the first element of five of a self-defense claim is that element of innocence. You must not have been the physical aggressor in the fight. If you're the physical aggressor in the fight, the first to threaten or use force, unlawful force, then you lose self-defense. You're losing that required element of innocence. Now, interestingly, mutual combat is treated somewhat differently in non-deadly force cases than it is in deadly force cases. So say we're just talking about a simple fist fight, no deadly force involved, a non-deadly force conflict. In many states, what they'll do in cases of non-deadly force mutual combat is neither party qualifies to claim self-defense. Neither party qualifies to justify their use of force as lawful defensive force because they're mutual combatants, they're mutual aggressors, they've both lost innocence. But in the context of purely non-deadly force, what often happens is the law takes the position that each party consented to the other party's use of force against them. And if you consented to it, then that other person's use of force was not unlawful. Doesn't mean they were justified or that you were justified. Neither of you were. But because when you agreed to get into a fight, you consented to that guy throwing punches at you, and you were throwing punches at him, he consented to your punches as well, that neither of you can, in effect, bring charges against the other. So that's one approach. But that only ever applies when we're talking only about non-deadly force. Two parties cannot consent to a deadly force fight, because what would that be? That would be a duel to the death, and the law does not allow for duels to the death. So how mutual combat is treated in the context of a deadly force confrontation is different. Now, let's assume it's a deadly force confrontation in which one party dies. They're the victim now of the other party's use of force. That other party finds themselves charged with murder. They intentionally killed that other person. What they may try to argue is mutual combat as a defense. They can't claim self-defense because they were a mutual combatant, a mutual aggressor. They've lost innocence. Self-defense is off the table. But what they can argue is that it was mutual combat, and the emotional provocation of being in mutual combat essentially mitigates what would otherwise be a murder conviction down to a voluntary manslaughter conviction. Voluntary manslaughter being when you intend to cause some other person harm, maybe foreseeable deadly harm, but because of the emotions, the emotional provocation of the moment, your brain was incapable of forming the specific intent to kill that's required for a murder conviction. The argument can be made in a deadly force case that would otherwise result in a murder conviction that the mutual combat, the fact that both parties agreed to get into the fight, should be a similar kind of trigger that mitigates murder down to manslaughter. That's why this appellant was making this argument. For one thing, he wasn't worried about getting convicted of malice murder. He was already convicted of malice murder when he brought this appeal, and he's trying to get it mitigated down to manslaughter. So he'll have some chance sometime in his life to get out of prison again. Obviously, here he was not successful in doing that. Appropriately so. To get back to this appellate court decision, the court actually writes in its findings that, and I'll quote here, paraphrasing a little bit, a charge on mutual combat generally is proper when there is evidence of a mutual intention or agreement to fight. In this case, there is no evidence that the victim had an intention to fight the appellant. The evidence shows that the argument was between the victim and the appellant's friends, that the victim came out with the gun only after being told that the appellants were driving back and forth in front of his house, but he kept the gun by his side. He did not attempt to use it even when the appellant's friends were punching him and trying to take his own gun away. And the victim exchanged gunfire with the appellant and his friends only after he'd been shot in the face. Clearly, this was not someone who was willingly getting into a fight. The fight came to him. He didn't go to the fight. So it was on those facts that the court, again, concluded mutual combat was not a credible defense in this case. Therefore, it was not ineffective assistance of counsel not to request a mutual combat jury instruction, and they affirmed this appellant's conviction. If you'd like to read the full text of this appellate decision, and we always encourage you to do so, you can find it linked at our Patreon page at patreon.com/lawofselfdefense. That's it for our case of the week. Keep in mind, the Handgun World podcast audience can always get 10% off everything at lawofselfdefense.com simply by pointing your browser to lawofselfdefense.com/handgunworld or by using the discount code HandgunWorld at checkout. And either way, a small part of your purchase will come right back to the Handgun World podcast. Until next time, I'm attorney Andrew Branca for lawofselfdefense.com.
All right. Thank you, Andrew Branca, for always good informative stuff from the Law of Self-Defense. You need to know this stuff. And by the way, if you want to buy Andrew's products, as he mentioned, please use my affiliate page, which is lawofselfdefense.com/handgunworld. Once again, lawofselfdefense.com/handgunworld. Ben Branham is also going to be teaching some classes coming up, so check out his page, modernselfprotection.com/courses. Ben's a great instructor, and I used to teach with him. I'm going to start teaching with him, conjunction with him again, doing some joint instructor classes, and that's going to be in 2019. But check out what he's got coming up for 2018. I think you're going to like it. modernselfprotection.com/courses. And John Payne from Suarez International is also going to be coming to the San Antonio area, folks, to put on a shotgun class. Now, this is not something that is being taught a lot anymore. I don't know why. Shotgun gunfighting. And I'll put a link in the show notes. That's April 14th and 15th, John Payne's shotgun class. And I got to be there for that one. Whenever there's a local class, I need to try to take advantage of local classes. Now, let me finish by saying, please check out my YouTube channel. I've got some new videos up there. I'm going to be starting a new video series that I'm going to announce on February 15th. Actually, I'm going to start releasing some of the videos probably later, probably within about 2 or 3 days after this podcast publishes. So be checking out my video channel, my YouTube channel. It's, if you search Handgun World on YouTube, Handgun World on YouTube, Handgun World Show, you'll find me on YouTube. A lot of people have been asking me to do more videos, so I'm answering the call. And you're going to see a pretty cool video series starting real soon. So sign up for that. I'm going to put a link in the show notes again so you can go straight to my YouTube channel if you wish to do that. Please remember to join our Shooters Club and watch some excellent videos that will help you. You'll learn a lot from watching videos for only $8 a month, $75 a year. Thank you to all of you using my Amazon store to make your Amazon purchases. All this helps support my show, and I don't have a whole lot of sponsors on this, so I like to keep this listener supported as much as possible. And I promise in my next episode that comes out on the 15th of February, I am going to be talking about some real good listener voicemails that I received recently, some real good ones. So that's coming out on the 15th. Remember, this podcast now comes out on the 1st and 15th of every month, and my short YouTube videos are going to probably come out once a week. If you want to be a sponsor on the Handgun World podcast, let me know. Handgunworld@gmail.com. We can discuss it. It's got to be a product that either I've used or you're willing to let me use it and evaluate it before I start advertising for you. But let me know if you want to sponsor. Handgunworld.com is my email for you to use. Last but not least, the voicemail, 210-646-1727. 210-646-1727. Let me close by saying, you know, the internet gives everyone a voice, but it doesn't give everyone a brain. Have you noticed that? Shoot straight, shoot safe, read your Bible every day, And I'm Bob Main. I'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.